With the Parsha of Mishpatim, we move, as by name and by nature, into the realms of Mishpatim, many, many mitzvos to consider. And of course the Parsha begins with the first of the Mishpatim, Eved Ivri. And interestingly, for the Netziv, the discussion of Eved Ivri begins with the name itself, Eved Ivri. We're used to it, Eved Ivri. It's practically one word for us, like Shalshudas. But the Netziv notes that by this stage in the Torah, we don't normally refer to Jews as Ivris, as Hebrews. We are Yisrael by this stage. I don't think we will ever find a reference to Ivri, and also not in the balance of Parshas Mishpatim as well. Therefore, we are moved to ask, why is it that this Eved, who is Jewish, of course, Eved Kanani is a whole separate discussion, why is he referred to by the Torah as an Eved Ivri and not as an Eved Yisraeli? And the Netziv explains, it's very interesting to consider, that there is a difference in connotation for us between the word term Ivri and Yisrael. Yisrael represents the Jewish people as they achieve their distinction. It says Yisrael mi Mitzrayim, and from a certain point of view, from that point, there's no looking back. Ivri represents someone who's more ethnically or nationally part of that people. It doesn't necessarily have a connotation of any particular distinction. He belongs to the Hebrew people, as surely as originally the name Yisrael was given as some form of attainment to Yaakov. So too, Yisrael represents the Jewish people as they became a special people. And Ivri represents someone who is part of the people, but perhaps not much more than that. And with this in mind, the Netziv takes us back, and we will see with new eyes how this will explain to us the psukim, the first exchange between Moshe and Paro, when there was yet a concept of Ivri. And this is in the beginning of Perek Hay. Everyone is ready, Moshe has received his instructions, the Jewish people have been briefed, and Moshe and Aaron come to Paro. And let us see these psukim. Pasuk Aleph, Achar ba'u Moshe ba'aron vayomu el Paro, ko amar Hashem Elokei Yisrael, shalach esami v'yochogu li ba'midbar. So that's the famous, let them go, as Mefarshim have noted, let my people go, never stands alone. It's always followed by something constructive. Let my people go and they will do something. V'yochogu li ba'midbar. Paro says, Pasuk Beis, not interested. Vayomer Paro, mi Hashem asher shma b'kolo l'shalach es Yisrael, lo yadati es Hashem, I don't know of him, he's not in my directory, v'gam es Yisrael lo ashaleach. So the question was, or the petition was, let them go. The answer is no. And then, Pasuk Gimel, it's Nochamo. Vayomru, Elokei ha'ivrim, nikra aleinu. So Moshe asks again, and Paro reacts again. He says no, but not only does he say no, he's offended at this stage. Why would you disrupt the people from their work? Paro has a very strong work ethic when it comes to his slaves. Go about your business. So we should note, just in terms of Parshanut, that the question seems to have been asked twice. Paro says no both times, but the first time he merely says, I don't recognize this, and the second time he's upset. This will disrupt them from their work. And then Netziv explains, and it's a new insight now into this group of psukim, that in fact Moshe is asking for two separate things. His first request is for Yisrael. That is how he introduces it in Pasuk Aleph. Ko Amar Hashem Elokei Yisrael. Elokei Yisrael, the God of Israel, at that stage refers specifically to Hashem as the God of those people of distinction. For there was a group, a subgroup within the larger Ivri group. The request for them is Yachoguli Bamidbar. Now Yachogu, to celebrate religiously, is something which is first and foremost in the lot of those that are called Yisrael. It's for people of distinction to have such a religious experience. It's reminiscent, in fact, and important to remember, as we do, that in the Simchas Pesach Shoeva, on Chol HaMoed Sukkos, of which is described at length in the fifth parak of Maseches Sukkah, so everyone was there. But those that were in the middle and the center, as they should be, as the Mishnah describes them, Chasidim v'Anshei Maaseh, they were the ones that were dancing. Everyone else was, in a sense, watching, really. That was the nature of their participation. I'm not sure exactly who decided who were the Chasidim and the Anshei Maaseh. It tends to be the nature of Chasidim and Anshei Maaseh to shy away from owning up to that. But nonetheless, we do see that there is this distinction. The height of the religious celebration is for those that are of the religious heights. Now, interestingly, there's no time limit set here. There's no 3 days yet. It's Bi'achogli Bamidbar. It's open-ended. And that's the request. Paro refuses simply because he doesn't recognize this. He doesn't recognize Elokei Yisrael. But on the other hand, we don't yet find at this stage that he's upset. This will be a disruption of the work, because the number of people within the broader Jewish people, shall we call them, who deserve the title of Yisrael, may not have been that great. So that might not yet be a disruption of the work. So far, it sounds like the elite, quote-unquote, will go for this Yachogli Bamidbar for an extended period. Everybody else, it seems, will stay, and therefore the work will continue, bigadol. Which means that Paro's grounds for refusal can't be that, how can you take my workforce away? Yisrael don't represent his workforce. They probably weren't the better of the workers anyway. However, at Pasuk Gimel, Moshe asked what is essentially another request. I'm not sure why they're ordered this way, but this is something else. Everyone is going to be involved in some degree, even the Ivrim, who represent the broader Jewish people. So for this, there's a time limit of 3 days, not unlimited. To offer korbanos, everyone can and should be offering korbanos. There isn't that experiential higher level called v'yachoguli bamidbar, but nonetheless, to bring korbanos. At that stage, when it's the discussion is whether the Ivrim should leave, which is essentially the entire nation, Paro's upset. The entire nation, even for 3 days. Tafriyu es ha'am mimasav, and Paro gets upset. And so, we find that at that early stage, we can already perceive a distinction between Ivri, which is the lowest common denominator of Jewish affiliation by nature, perhaps not that much more, and then Yisrael, those that had achieved this higher level of distinction. From the time we left Mitzrayim, there's no more Ivrim. Says the Netziv, the reason why is because anyone who didn't want to leave, who would be most qualified to call Ivri, didn't leave. As we know, it's a very sad part of Yetzias Mitzrayim. V'chamushim alu b'nei Yisrael me'etz Mitzrayim, the majority, 80%, 4 out of 5, felt very much at home in Mitzrayim. And were not prepared for Yetzias Mitzrayim. They died out in the 3 days of darkness. And from this point onwards, there are no Ivrim anymore, because anyone who signed on for leaving has already registered that they're electing for more than just Jewish by birth. And therefore, it is Yisrael that leave Mitzrayim. From this point on, we will never hear the term Ivri again. because out of the Ivrim came Yisrael. The exception now is Eved Ivri. We understand that there's a certain connotation here. There's a certain characterization. We're talking about someone he's stolen, right? He's stolen so much he can't repay his debts. He doesn't really represent the best of what Judaism is about. He's almost, to a degree, a throwback Ivri times. He's Jewish. You've got to take care of him. You have to deal with him appropriately. But he's back to the Ivri level. And that's why he's called that. Indeed, just to add a certain further point, geneva, stealing, is not a prohibition that's unique to the Jewish people. It's one of the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach. Ramban says, dinim, a basic judicial system with basic laws, is the lot, as far as the Torah is concerned, of all of humanity. Which means this person, perhaps, not only has he compromised his distinction as a Yisrael, he's violated something that even were he only to be an Ivri would be objectionable. And thus he is called Eved Ivri. The exception, of course, someone who was of ultimate distinction, who is nonetheless called an Ivri, is Avram HaIvri. In Parshas Lech Lecha, he's only called Ivri once. It feels like he's called Ivri a lot, but the Torah only ever calls him Ivri once. Vayavo HaPalit, Vayaged LaAvram HaIvri. Of course, there it doesn't represent a lack of distinction, but there was no Jewish people yet. There was no Yisrael to speak of. He is yet the forerunner of the Jewish people, and thus he is called an Ivri. So it's very interesting, even just in terms of the nomenclature, Eved Ivri, that we're so familiar with, it's already a statement about the type of person that we're talking about. It gives us the color and the atmosphere of this personality. Now, Mishpatim, as we move into Mishpatim, deal with many of the laws ben Adam l'chaveiro, and I'd like to take a look at one of the classic areas of nezikim, what's called of damage, and that is the area of bor, of a pit. It's one of the arba avos nezikin, arba avos nezikin, shor, bor, mave, and hever. It's one of the four primary categories, and it's referred to in Perek Kaf Aleph, Pasuk Lamed Gimel. And as we'll see, there's quite a bit to say. What's unique about a bor, just by way of preference, after all, if it does damage like the others, why does it have its own category? It is unique, because unlike the others, it doesn't move. It doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't do damage. People only become damaged by moving towards it or into it. And that's already a unique category. Everything else, it either moves or it spreads. An animal or fire or a person. The boar stays where it is. You have to be a schlemazel to get involved in it. But nonetheless, you can't. No one can ever say, well, you know, it's his fault or his animal's fault. Rather, the person is chayev. Whoever dug the pit is chayev to pay. Let us see the pasuk. Pasuk Lamed Gimel, v'chiyivtach ishbor. If a person will open a pit, that is to say, uncover a pit, maybe a manhole, it could be that it's been dug, covered over appropriately, sufficiently, he uncovers it, he's responsible. O kiyichra ishbor. Or if he digs a pit, v'lo yichasenu, and then doesn't cover it over sufficiently to allow traffic to flow safely over it. V'nafal shama shor or chamor, an ox or a donkey falls into it, Baal habor yishale. The owner of the pit needs to pay. The rest of that pasuk lamed dalet will leave for now. It's the particulars of exactly how the payment is worked out. Now, one of the basic questions that will need to be addressed is the fact that the pasuk has given us two ways of this person being associated with the pit, either by uncovering it or by digging it. Ki yiftach yishbor o ki yichre yishbor. And the question, of course, is, as is voiced by Rashi, is that there seems to be a kal vachomer. After all, if the pit was already dug, he didn't dig the pit. It was covered. All he did was he uncovered it. And we already say, well, that's your pit now. You're responsible. You didn't dig it, but it was covered and you uncovered it. You exposed it. If already there he's liable for the consequences of any damage that's caused, so then kal vachomer, if he actually, it was level ground and he dug the pit himself, he's created that pit. Kal vachomer, he should be liable. In which case, the second clause of Pasuk Lamed Gimel, O ki yichre ishbor, digging the pit, would seem to be completely redundant. Had the Pasuk just said, if you open a pit, you're liable, so kal vachomer if you dig the pit. That is the question. And Rashi voices it. O ki yichre, says Rashi, lama ne'emar. Why does the Pasuk need to say this? After all, im al ha-psicha chayev, if he's chayev for uncovering the pit, al hakriya lo kol shekein, for actually digging and creating it, all the more so. So what is the answer? Says Rashi, and this is one of the answers which is given in the Gemara, lehavi kore achar kore. The second clause of digging the pit is to include a situation where, in fact, the pit is mostly dug, and he comes and finishes it off. He now assumes responsibility for the entire thing. Your classic boar, says the Gemara, in order to be considered a dangerous boar, a life-threatening boar, needs to have a minimum of 10 tvachim. What if it's 9 tvachim? Well, it's not yet considered to be a life-threatening affair. Should this person come across a pit of 9 tvachim, and he sets about digging and brings it to a depth of 10 tvachim, he now is responsible for everything that happens. He has taken over as the honorary address for any complaints. And that's a chiddush, because he only did 10% of the digging, but it was the 10% that brought it from 90% to 100%. And therefore the first person who dug the 9 tvachim is off the hook. That's the good news. The bad news is the new person is on the hook. He assumes responsibility. That's the import of the second clause. And in fact, the Vilna Gaon, in classic style, as we know, his derech is, there's nothing that you find in the Gemara that isn't alluded to somewhere in the Chumash. Where do we see that when it comes to digging the pit, even if he only dug a little bit of the pit, but he brought it to that critical depth of 10 tvachim, that he assumes responsibility, that's the chiddush of the second clause, says the Vilna Gaon, look at the pasuk. You will see that the word bor is mentioned twice. V'chi yiftach yishbor, o ki yichre yishbor. Uncovering and digging. It's the same word, but it's not written exactly the same. The first mention of the word bor is written male, full, base, vavresh. The second time, with regards to digging, it's written chaser, base, resh. What is behind this distinction? Says the Gaon, the difference is, because since in the first clause we're talking about him uncovering a pit, so how deep is the pit? Is it a full pit? It must be, because otherwise he wouldn't assume liability for uncovering it. And therefore, because the bore is complete, the word bore is written complete when it comes to uncovering. Whereas in the second part of the pasuk, when it's talking about him digging, so in fact, when he now engages in digging, the bore is incomplete. He brings it to completion, and therefore his act of kriya relates to and engages with a bore which is itself chaser, less than complete. That's why the word bore itself is written less than complete. So that's the Vilna Gaon on the two bores there, one male, one chaser. Now, we should know, Rashi has given his response to why the word, why the pasuk gives a separate clause of digging, even though it's redundant, superfluous, from the uncovering. The Gemara says something else. This is the Gemara in the fifth parak of Maseches Bava Kama and Daf Nun Aleph. The Gemara says that we learn from here, you see, normally the other types of objects that damage, they tend to be yours. If they're ownerless, then that's not your responsibility. What if you dig a pit in a place that's ownerless, or maybe owned by everyone, namely in the middle of the public thoroughfare? Bor, birshus harabim. Not yours, you don't own the road. Some people drive like they do, but essentially no one really does. And therefore, are you liable? Is that connected to you? That is what we learn from the second phrase, ki yichre ishbor, means wherever you dig, Even if you dig in a place that you don't own, could be someone else's property, it could be no one's property, you'll always be liable. This is where we derive the obligation of bor birshus harabim. It's also true, if we move to the beginning of Pasuk Lamed Daled, Baal Habor Yishalem, the owner of the pit, which means that a person can also incur liability for a pit that he owns, that's in his domain. The situation would be if it's exactly at the edge of the road. People are entitled to walk along the full width of the road, which means he cannot dig a pit right in the, even if it's in his property, right next to the road. A person could fall off into his pit. Baal Habor Yishalem, that's his pit. And he would be liable. And therefore, between these two phrases, ki yichre, which is the action of digging, which gives us his obligation in the public thoroughfare, Baal Habor Yishalem, responsibility if he irresponsibly has his pit in his domain but too close to the public thoroughfare where people are free to go, in both cases, he will be liable. Now, it seems as if the Pasuk has merely supplied for us locations. Public thoroughfare, private property, in both will be obligated. But the truth is, there's more than that. The Torah is not merely telling us that he'll be liable in both places. It's not two alternative locations. These are actually two different types of obligation. It devolves from a different aspect of this person and the bor and the pit. That is to say, when it comes to the Rishus Harabim, it's not his. How does it become associated to him? By virtue of what? By virtue of his criminal act of digging the pit in the Rishus Harabim. It's his action that generates his liability. The action of digging. When it comes to the Rishus HaYochid, his own property, it's not his action of digging that generates the liability. It's his ownership of the offending pit. So there is liability that's a function of criminal action, and liability that's a function of ownership, and they're not the same. And the simple scenario that would separate them is, what if a person owns the pit, but he never dug it? What if he bought a field? And he is now the proud owner of this territory, which happens to have a pit right next to the public thoroughfare that he didn't dig. So there's been no criminal act. It's not a crime to buy a field. But on the other hand, he is now the owner of this pit, and he will be responsible. So this will be the case where that difference will come out. The more prevalent scenarios in practical halacha that deal with cases of bor, where people no longer really dig pits unless they're working for the government. So it's more someone who leaves his objects in a place where people could more likely trip over them, not so much fall into them, but trip over them. That's also a type of bor. And he's responsible. He cannot claim the person should have looked where he was going. The Gemara states its famous formulation at the beginning of the third parak of Bava Kama, Ein darkam shel bnei adam lehisponein badrachim. It's not the way of people, as they're walking along, keep their eyes fixed at the ground in front of them to make sure that nothing is askew or amiss. There are no protrusions or the like. And therefore, the responsibility and liability is entirely of the person who left his briefcase or his bag or whatever it is that he left. This, the Gemara said, it's not the nature of people to look, to pay attention to the road, any aberrations in the landscape as they're going along. We should note, this was said in the pre-cell phone era, as certainly kal vachomer nowadays, when certain people are engaged with whoever they're talking to, it's not their way to be misponing in anything, even things that are directly in front of them, which results in a phenomenon of people deep in conversation being pounced upon and accosted by fire hydrants and lampposts and the like. But at least in terms of things that are underfoot, the Gemara has established. Just conclude with a very thought-provoking episode, which happened in the Slabodka Yeshiva. The Alter Slabodka, Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel, the master educator, he called aside once one of the Bochrim, and he upbraided him. He said, "Your countenance, it's too serious. Wherever you go, you always have a sour face." And it's osur. It's osur to walk around like that. Now, you know, when you talk to a yeshiva student and you say the word osur, he'll want chapter and verse. Osur, where's the isur? That's what the Talmud asked. And the Alter said the isur is from Parshas Mishpatim, Bor B'Shus HaRabim. You are a public hazard. Anyone who comes across you, you're in the public thoroughfare. Anyone who looks at you, you bring them down, you ruin their mood. You're a Bor B'Shus HaRabim, you have to learn to smile. So it's interesting to see how what comes from physically tripping over something can very easily become emotionally ruining everything for someone. That's also Bor B'Shus HaRabim. Person needs to have a public awareness in that respect as well. Okay, so these are some of the highlights from the sugya of Bor. Of course, there's plenty more to talk about. When we had the shiurim in the Maseches Bava Kama, the yeshiva, so after one particularly involved shiur, one of my talmidim who thought he could get away with it, he came up and said, "Rabbi, I just wanted to tell you, I thought that shiur was a complete bore." So I said, "I'm sorry to hear that. I guess it means you didn't dig it." Anyway, okay. So from there, we move from one of the areas of Mishpatim to one of the classic principles of Mishpatim. And that is the concept of Acharei Rabim Lahatos. Now, that is to be found in Perek Kaf Gimel Pasuk Beis. The Pasuk itself is very difficult. Generally, when we quote the Pasuk, we focus on the final three words, Acharei Rabim Lahatos. And we're not going to get, at this occasion, into the parshanut of the entire pasuk. And yet we know the principle, and it's a classic setting, of course, is a Beis Din. If you have a dispute between Chachamim, the rule of thumb is Acharei Rabim Lahatos. Also with regards to Isur, we follow the Rov in many respects. We follow the majority. There's plenty of details and fine-tuning there. But it is certainly appropriate to say about this concept, it is a klal godol batorah, to follow the majority. Now, with this in mind, we should call and recall a famous episode which seems to be somewhat to the side of this. And we refer, of course, to the confrontation between Rabbi Eliezer and the Chachamim regarding the Tanur Shel Achnai, the snake oven, which is recorded in Maseches Bava Metzia and Daf Nun Tes. The snake oven, briefly, is the rules are of Kabbalas Tuma. If it's an earthenware vessel, it can be Mekabel Tuma. If it's made only of dirt, it's not Mekabel Tuma. And along came some Chacham, and he devised an oven, and the oven essentially is a large vessel with nothing at the bottom, so one can cook things there. And it was layered. So you had one layer of earthenware, on top of that a layer of dirt. Earthenware, dirt. So it was half-half. And this became probably the most famous oven in the entire Talmud. Because the question arose, is it Mekabel Tuma? After all, it's half of it is earthenware, but then the other half is dirt. Is it Tomei? Is it Tohor? This was a machlokus between Rabbi Eliezer, on the one hand, and apparently everyone else on the other hand. And they were arguing back and forth, and Rabbi Eliezer did not back down. Everyone was arguing with him, and he wouldn't accept their verdict. In the end, they put him in chayr. It was considered too excessive. But the question is, on the simplest level, does Rabbi Eliezer not know there's a principle of Acharei Rabim Lahatos? He said his piece. He's presented his arguments. They presented their arguments. And they're going back and forth. They've reached a gridlock. At that point, you've got to call it a day. The individual is bound to follow the majority. Acharei Rabim Lahatos. How are we to understand that Rabbi Eliezer could be offside of such a major concept? Mefarshim explain. We should know something about Rabbi Eliezer. The Gemara in Maseches Nida and Daf Zayin refers to Rabbi Eliezer with the term Shamusi. Shamuti. Rabbi Eliezer is Shamusi. Now what does Shamusi mean? Actually, there are a couple of interpretations. Some say the Aruch, one of the Rishonim, says he's called Shamuti from the word Shamta, because he was put in Cherem. Shamta is an expression of Cherem. Rabbi Eliezer, but Rashi says there in his commentary that Rabbi Eliezer is called Shamusi because he identified with the school of Shammai. He was a Shammainik, Shamuti. Now, how is that relevant? The Gemara tells us in Maseches Yevamos in Daf Tesvav, where it's one of the places where it describes at length the disputes between Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. And the Gemara says something which is quite striking. And that is, according to one opinion, we know Beis Hillel, Beis Shammai, the halacha is like Beis Hillel. That for us is a known thing. Beis Hillel were the majority, which is also very significant. There were many more Beis Hillel than there were of Beis Shammai. However, says the Gemara, Beis Shammai themselves did not back down. Even when they were outvoted and they were in the minority, they still persisted in acting according to the way they thought the halacha should be. How can this be explained? How can this be justified? Says the Gemara, Mishum dehavu mechadedei tfei. Because they were mechadedei. Mechudadim, they were sharper. And apparently that was accepted. That was a recognized fact. Because they were sharper, they refused to accede to the majority who were Beis Hillel, who they considered to be not as sharp as them. Now, we still need to explain how that can be. But that's a fact. Therefore, according to Beis Shammai, if you ever have a dispute where the majority rules one way, the minority disputes them, but the minority somehow can be classified as sharper, a higher plane intellectually and otherwise, or in halachically, than them, he doesn't need to accede to them. Such a person was Rabbi Eliezer, as we know. In fact, that was the testimony of his own Rebbe, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, as we read in Pirkei Avos, in the second perek, Hu Haya Omer. If all the Chachamim of Israel were on one side, and Rabbi Eliezer was on the other side, Machria es Kulam. He could outweigh all of them. That was said in praise of Rabbi Eliezer by Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. And therefore, in keeping with the principle of Beis Shammai, because Rabbi Eliezer is Shamusi, if you're Mechadei de Tfei, if he's sharper than them, he didn't feel that he needed to follow them. That's the interim explanation. Except, this idea, as much as it's a fact, itself needs to be explained. How can Beis Shammai say, the Torah says, Achar Rabban Lahatas, you have to follow the majority, but we don't, because we're smarter. The Torah doesn't seem to have made any caveats. The Torah seems to have stated it across the board. Achar Rabban Lahatas, you can't say, well, that's true for the proletariat, but we're in a different league. The Torah doesn't seem to have provided for a different league. Moreover, presumably, everyone, when they're in an argument, feels that they're the sharper side. they say things the way they see it. As far as they're concerned, they're correct. As soon as you introduce this concept of if you're sharper, you don't need to accede to the majority, essentially, you have disabled the entire process, which is called following majority. Because go prove that the majority are smarter than you. As long as the minority can claim we're mechadedei tfei, you can always claim an exception, in which case the entire principle threatens to fall into disuse. How can this be quantified or monitored in any way? Says the Be'er Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Salant. And the roots, as we will see, are in the Chasam Sofer. everyone holds to the principle of following the majority. There's no way out. The Torah says Acharav Nahatus. The machlokus beis Hillel and beis Shammai is not whether or not one should follow the majority. The machlokus is what defines the majority. What is the Torah talking about when it says follow the rove, follow the rabbin? That is the question. According to beis Hillel, rabbin means, perhaps in the simple way that we understand, it means most votes, most people. Beis Shammai dispute that interpretation of what majority means, because if an idea perhaps is not the correct way of looking at it, the fact that more people think that doesn't make it correct. How can it be demonstrated it's correct? Can you prove it in how many ways? How many arguments can you advance to show that you're right? That's the rabbim. It's rabbim in terms of how much chokhmah do you bring to the equation. They have one argument in their favor. You may have 10 arguments in your favor. They may be 10 people sharing the same argument. You're one person. You have 10 times their arguments. As far as Beis Shammai is concerned, that's rabbim. That's the majority. The most is there with the minority. That's very interesting. And that actually, although the Be'er Yosef doesn't quote it, but I found later on, This is the explanation of the Chasam Sofer in the Tshuvas in Eben Ezer. Siman Ayin Aleph. His words are two lines. Right, there was a suffix. I halacha ki Beis Shammai de mechadde. Is the halacha like Beis Shammai? They're proper. Afagav de Beis Hillel have a ruba. Even though Beis Hillel are more, mikomakom Beis Shammai rabosi badeos hayu. They were more in terms of, they could say more, they could prove more, they could demonstrate more. There were fewer of them, but they could do more than the majority that was against them. So we're in a very interesting situation, because there's a principle that everyone subscribes to, but their machlokus is, how do you define it? Everyone defines it in a way that works for them. But to come back to Rabbi Eliezer now, it's not merely a case of saying, I'm immune from following the majority. Rabbi Eliezer is one person who is capable of saying, I am the majority. The Gemara says in its description of that story, Ba'osto Yom, Heshiv Rabbi Eliezer kol tshuva sheba olam. Rabbi Eliezer was just an unending source of arguments for his position. Called Shuva Sheba Olam. He outnumbered in total everyone who was in terms of arguments that were contrary to him. So that's a deeper understanding of Beis Hillel. This is classic Beis Shammai. I'm not saying he's not ignoring the majority. He's claiming the majority. Now it's interesting to note in this respect, for as we know, there's a famous principle. Lava Shemayim hi, when it comes to deciding halacha, we don't take note of heavenly voices and not of nevuah. It's inadmissible. Now we know that in the machlokas Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, the halacha follows Beis Hillel. Why? We may be interested to find out that the reason why we pass them like Beis Hillel is because the Baskel came out and said halacha is like Beis Hillel. That's referred to in Masechet Se'irvin and Daf Yud Gimel. They were gridlocked. Each one says, Allah is like me. And then a Baskel came out. And they can't ignore a Baskel. And we don't. Except, says Tosfos, but I thought we do. Isn't that true? You don't take notice of a Baskel. So why is it that the whole matter was arbitrated by the Baskel here? Says Tosfos, this was an unusual situation. Because the whole halachic process was gridlocked. The point of not paying attention to a baskol, to extracurricular input, is because you should be able to work it out by yourselves. You've got the tools, acharabim lahatos. But what happens when the tools themselves are under dispute? So you don't even have the wherewithal to settle. And therefore, on this unique occasion, when the baskol came out, it wasn't so much to say the halacha is like Beis Hillel, but it's to say that the definition of majority is in accordance with the way Beis Hillel defined it, namely, it's the majority of people. Once that's been established, you're back on track. You can now pass on the halacha without any further interference or contributions from a Bascom. That's what's behind this historic Bascom of Basila. Interesting to note, an equally famous Bascom was actually part of that episode with Rebbe Elazar and the Chachamim, because when he saw that he wasn't persuading them, even though he was sure he was right, he called for a number of signs from heaven that he's correct, and they ignored all of them, and then he called for a Bascom, Rebbe Elazar, that a Bascom yochiach, tochiach, and moreover, a Bascom came out and said the halachas like Rebbe Elazar, and that's when Rebbe Yeshua stood up and made his famous pronouncement, Lo b'shamayim hi, we're not interested in the Bascom, we're deciding halacha, please don't get involved, and the halacha is not like Rebbe Elazar. So we well understand why Rebbe Yeshua ignored the Bascom, because the majority had ruled not like Rebbe Elazar. The only mystery is, why would Rebbe Elazar call for a Bascom? Does he not realize that the majority is not on his side? The definition of majority has already been decided by the prior Bascom. What did he hope to gain by calling out for this Bascom? But in any case, it didn't help him. So this is further insight into that famous episode of the snake oven, Tanur Shel Achnai, to understand what was behind the sides of each. And in a classic final segment of this discussion, says Ber Yosef, this analysis will explain for us now a classic section of the Gemara which deals with the halachas of Kiddush, which is recorded twice actually, but in Brachos Msochim, it's in Brachos in the beginning of the 8th Perek Daf Nun Aleph Amud Beis. And as we know, there are two brachos that we make in Kiddush on Friday night. You make a hagofen on the wine, and Mikadosh HaShabbos. The question is, which bracha do you make first? And interestingly, it's a machlokus between Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. If you've seen the Mishnah, so you'll know it's a machlokus. And a braisa in the Gemara explains exactly the background. Why would you say hagofen first? Which we do, of course. That's Beis Hillel. Why would you say the bracha on the day first? Well, the Brisa explains. Firstly, Beis Shammai's arguments for saying Mekadosh HaShabbos first. Number one, says Beis Shammai, what's Kiddush all about at the end of the day, or more correctly, at the beginning of the day? It's about Shabbos, and therefore the wine is all, you wouldn't be drinking wine. You wouldn't have to drink wine if it wasn't for Shabbos. So Shabbos is what it's all about. Shabbos should come first. That's number one. That's argument number one. Argument number two, says Beis Shammai, Shabbos came, it's been Shabbos already for a while before you made Kiddush, and therefore it's almost like Shabbos happened earlier, should be referenced earlier. That's Beis Shammai. What do Beis Hillel have to say about all of this? Well, they actually have arguments of their own. Two, in fact, says Beis Hillel. Number one, why should you make Hagofen first? Because if you didn't have Hagofen, you wouldn't be entitled to make Kiddush. And therefore the Hagofen, the wine in its own way, is the anchor of the Kiddush. No wine, you can't just make the Mekadosh HaShabbos by itself. So the wine allows for Kiddush to happen. And number two, says Beis Hillel, and this may be a well-known principle for us, if these two brachas, one of them is more common, otherwise known as Tadir. Hagofen, you make frequently, Mekadosh HaShabbos once a week. And therefore, Tadir, Rishenu Tadir, Tadir Kodim, the one that's more common, always comes first. That's it. Those are all of the exhibits for Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai are out. And the Braisa conclude, and the halachas like Beis Hillel. Now, the Gemara asks two questions. Firstly, says the Gemara, why did you have to give me like additional arguments for Beis Hillel? He told me one argument, and then he said, and another thing, why did you have to tell me that other thing? Says the Gemara, because otherwise I might think, well, Beis Shammai have two arguments, and I only have one argument, that would be awkward. So therefore, know ye that Beis Hillel also have two arguments, that's why. But then the Gemara asks another question. The Braisa said, the halacha is like Beis Hillel, that's redundant. The halacha is always like Beis Hillel. I never need to that pronouncement at the end. Why did the Braisa see fit to have to tell me the halacha is like Beis Hillel? Says the Gemara, because this Braisa is very old. This Braisa was written before the Bascom, which came and settled everything that gave us our principle, the halacha is like Beis Hillel. Before that, you never knew, so the Braisa needed to tell you the halacha is like Beis Hillel. End quote. Says the Be'er Yosef. Where do we ever find that we start numbering our arguments, and they have two arguments, and he also needs to have two arguments. Why is it so much of the essence here? You may think it's two arguments against one. Nope. It's two on two. And secondly, the Gemara asked, why do you have to say that the halacha is like Beis Hillel? It's always like Beis Hillel, isn't it? And says the Gemara answered, this is before the Baskel. So you wouldn't know. So the Bar Yosef said, if you wouldn't know, then how do you know? If it's before the Baskel, which says the halacha is like Beis Hillel, then on what grounds do you say the halacha is like Beis Hillel? After all, no one knew. That was the whole point. Says Bar Yosef, in light of our discussion, this Gemara reads like a dream. In other words, prior to the Baskel, the reason why you could never know if the halachas like Beis Hillel or Beis Shammai is because Beis Shammai always had more to say. That was how they defined the Rov. If you had two arguments, they'll have four arguments. If you have one, they'll have two. Which means there's more of you, but they have more arguments, and that's why it was gridlocked. Should you ever find a situation, and it could happen, and that's what happened here, where the way it turned out is that the number of arguments presented for each side was equal. At that stage, even Beis Shammai would have to accede to Beis Hillel, because by this stage you can't claim majority based on Deos arguments, because they have equal number of arguments. At this point, when there's more of them of use of the Braisa, we're comfortable, even without any Baskel, to know the halachas like Beis Hillel. So this is a very wonderful insight into such a major concept that we know as Acharei Avin Lahatav. It's interesting to note, by the way, that the reason why Beis Shammai were smarter, I mean, what did they eat? That they were typically smarter than Beis Hillel. There was always fewer of them. Rabbi Avraham Margolius, in the Sefer Yesod HaMishnah Barichusa, explains that Beis Shammai were smarter because they were more selective in terms of the Talmidim that they accepted in the first place. The Ovester of Nosson presents for us Beis Shammai's criteria. You've got to be this, you've got to be this, you've got to be miyuchas, you've got to be all these qualifications. So by definition, there would always be few of them, but person per person, they would always be on a higher level. Beis Hillel were much more inclusive in terms of those that they took in, which means that the average perhaps was not as high as Beis Shammai, but there would be more of them. It's very interesting because it's a machlokas, really, in Hashkafa. Who should you teach? And it was rehashed later on. This is the famous episode with Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah and Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbi Gamliel was the Nasi. This is in Yavne. And he acted in a very heavy-handed way with Rabbi Yeshua, and they deposed him. That's when Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Harayani Kevin Shivim Shana, and he became the Nasi. And when he did, the Gemara says they added 400 benches to the Beis HaMedrash because Rabbi Gamliel was very selective in terms of who he would teach. And Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, he was much more inclusive. So Rabbi Avraham Margolius says, this is not a new machlokas. It's very interesting. Rabbi Gamliel, he's a throwback to Beis Shammai. He introduced Beis Shammai's way of teaching into the Beis HaMedrash, which is very interesting because Rabbi Gamliel, the Nasi, is a descendant of Hillel. He doesn't just belong to Beis, he literally belongs to the family of Hillel. And yet we see there were those, even amongst, you know, born and bred Beis Hillel people, who identified more with Beis Shammai. Rabbi Gamliel was just, and therefore in Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, when he brought in what was called the new order of anyone who wants to learn can come and learn, essentially he's reinstituting the Beis Hillel. So these are just the patterns as perceived in terms of these episodes. Let's conclude by moving towards the end of the parsha in Perek Kaf Dalet. Perek Kaf Dalet is a whole entity unto itself because it is the section known as Bris Torah. Bris Torah, it's almost like Matan Torah again. We had in Parshas Yisro, of course, Aseres Adibros and Mamad Har Sinai, but it comes back again in Pasuk Kaf Dalet, pretty much till the end. Perek Kaf Dalet. And it's known as Bris Torah because in addition to standing at Har Sinai and receiving the luchos, there was a bris, there was the covenant, and it involved korbanos, it involved many things. And one of the psukim becomes the source of a major discussion even beyond Ma'amad Har Sinai. Have a look at Pasuk Ches. We are Perek Kaf Dalet, Pasuk Ches. So as we said, there are korbanos, and they read from the Sefer HaBris, and then you have Na'ase V'Nishma. Na'ase V'Nishma is in Parshas Mishpatim, not, I believe, in Parshas Yisro. Yisro, you have Na'ase. Mishpatim, you have Na'ase V'Nishma. Okay. So, Vayikach Moshe Hadam Vayizrok Alam, he took the blood, he sprinkled it on the people. Vayomer Hinei Dam HaBris, Ashekaras Hashem Yimachem, Al Kol Advar Me'ila. This is the blood of the covenant, because some of the blood was put on the Mizbeach. As it says in the end of Pasuk Vav. In Pasuk Vav, Vayikach Moshe Chatzi Adam, Vayosem Ba'agonis, he took half of the blood, Vachatzi Adam Zarak Alam Mizbeach. Half of the blood he put in these vessels, yet to be sprinkled on the Am. That's their half. And then half of the blood chaziat and darkal mizbeach, which represents on high. Now, this sprinkling of the blood on Bnei Yisrael has major ramifications. As we know, gerus, for the procedure of being misgayer. So physically, there are two things that a male needs, right? And there's a separate discussion for gerus for men and for women. And so what a male would need is mila, of course, and tevila. That's in addition to accepting mitzvahs, which is part of it and a discussion all on itself. What would happen if, so for a woman, of course, there is only tevila. I mean, that's it. That is the moment of transition. But for a man, there's actually two moments of transition. What if you only had one of them? It's an interesting shaila. What if a prospective ger, he has mila, but not tevila? What's his status? That's a machlokas. It's a machlokas between Tanoim, Rabbi Lezer, again, and Rabbi Yoshua. Rabbi Lezer says he's Jewish. That's all he needs. And Rabbi Yeshua says, no, he's not Jewish. He's in an interesting state because he's begun to become Jewish, but he's not half Jewish. He's not Jewish at all until he does both things. And each one presents their basis. Rabbi Lezer says, Mila alone is fine. Shekein matzinu ba'avoseinu, as we find with our forefathers. Shemalu velo tavlu, they became Jewish just through Mila. That's the assertion of Rabbi Eliezer. Now, which we know, that upon leaving Mitzrayim, certainly for purposes of Korban Pesach, b'damai chayi, so there was Mila for sure, and that's it. Rabbi Yeshua says, no, that's not true. There was also Tevila. They also toiled in a mikveh. Why? Well, how does he know this? The Pasuk doesn't say it. Says Rabbi Yeshua, my source is Pasuk Ches. Because Pasuk Ches says that Moshe took the blood and he sprinkled it on the people. You should know, says Rabbi Yeshua, that we have a principle. No one can ever have anything sprinkled on them if they haven't done tevila first. That is a principle throughout Torah. Ein hazaa below tevila. And therefore, if you look at the hazaa in this pasuk, it is essentially evidence of tevila. Where would they find in the Midbar a mikveh to be tovel in? It's another shaila. Be'er Shamirim probably was helped in that instance. And that's the end of the discussion. It's a very... Everyone's kind of said what they said, but in a sense we're left really looking back at Rabbi Eliezer. Explain yourself. After all, Rabbi Yeshua has explained himself. You have this concept of Hazaa, which is explicit in the Pasuk, and we know that there can be no hazar without tefillah, ergo equals that there was tefillah, and apparently it's necessary, and you seem to have just completely ignored it. How would Rabbi Eliezer respond to this argument of Rabbi Yeshua? And I've come across, to date, four possible responses to Rabbi Yeshua, and I'd like to share three of them. The first, actually, is from the Ritva, in his commentary on Maseches Yevamos. And it's interesting because he will take what we know as a discussion amongst Rishonim, he will demonstrate that it's a much earlier discussion. Perek Avdalad of Chumash Shemos. When did it happen? It talks about the Korbanos, and it talks about the Naseh V'Nishma. When did it occur? On this point, Nechlek Rishonim. There is a major dispute between Rashi and Rambam. Rashi is on record, says here, Perek Avdalad, Pasuk Aleph, this whole chapter happened before Matan Torah. It's written afterwards. It happens, says Rashi. Ein muktam u'mu'ucha b'Torah. But this happened before, on the 4th of Sivan, actually, prior to Aseres Hadibros. That's Rashi's approach. And he as a whole will explain the Pesukim accordingly. Ramban argues. Ramban, as we know, uses the concept of Ein muktam u'mu'ucha b'Torah very sparingly. For Ramban, it's behind the glass. In case of emergency, you can break and say Ein muktam u'mu'ucha b'Torah. But wherever possible, Ramban sees the Psukim Kisidron, and therefore it happened. It's written after Matan Torah, it happened after Matan Torah. That is the well-known machlokas. Says the Ritva, Rashi and Ramban were not the first two authorities to discuss this question. It predates them by hundreds of years. For it seems that this is actually what's behind the dispute between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua. Rabbi Yehoshua says, you need tefillah. Look, they had tefillah. Apparently you need it for Geirus. Rabbi Eliezer says, no, I never saw it. It's in the Pasuk. Says the Ritva, any Geirus that happened for the Jewish people took place before they received the Torah. They've got to be Jewish to receive the Torah. Which means you can only bring as evidence for what you need for Geirus things that happened before Matan Torah. Well, this whole sprinkling, which must have involved tefillah, did that happen before Matan Torah? That's the machlokas. That's the machlokas, Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua. To put names to faces, Rabbi Yehoshua understands like Rashi. It may be written in the Torah after Aseres Hadibros, but Ein muktam u'mu'ucha b'Torah. It happened before. And therefore, if it happened before, it was as a prelude to receiving the Torah. It's part of their geirus. They needed it, and so does everybody else. That's Rabbi Yehoshua. Whereas for Rabbi Eliezer, he understands what later would become the position of the Ramban. It's written after Matan Torah, it happened after Matan Torah, which means anything that you see that they needed, they didn't need it for Geirus, because their Geirus would have had to have been in place before they received the Torah. So this Tevila is not relevant for Geirus. So that's very interesting how a classic Parshanut Machlokas, Rashi and Ramban, is at the root of a Halachic Machlokas many centuries before. A second approach, once again, to have the question in front of us, Rabbi Yeshua says you need tefillah, as is adduced from the Hazar that they had, the sprinkling. Rabbi Eliezer doesn't seem to recognize it. But why not? So this question was addressed by Reb Zalman of Voloshin. Reb Zalman was the youngest brother of Reb Chaim of Voloshin. There were another couple in between, and they were all outstanding. And there's a sefer called Toldos Odom, which is a biography of Reb Zalman of Voloshin. It's called a biography in the loosest of senses. He never stopped learning, so the story of his life is the story of his Divrei Torah, essentially. But Reb Zalman said, if you want to understand why Rabbi Eliezer does not recognize the proof of Rabbi Yeshua from this sprinkling presupposes toiveling, look at Unkelus. You never know what you'll see. Unkelus translates... with regards to the pasuk says Vayizrok al Ha'am, literally means he sprinkled on the people. Unkelus translates Uzerak al Madbecha lechapara al Ama. He sprinkled that blood on the mizbeach as a kapara for the people. That's very interesting. Because what Unkelus has done is, and this is in a translation, this is Targum Unkelus. What he has done is he's explained that when the pasuk says he sprinkled it on the people, it doesn't mean physically that he actually sprinkled the blood on them. This is not a hazar in the normal sense. He sprinkled al ha'am for the people. But what was he sprinkling it on? The mizbeach. And therefore there was never a hazar. This pasuk doesn't have a hazar on the people. Without a hazar on the people, they don't need a tevilah. That's the position of Rabbi Eliezer. And should you say to me, well, what gives us to understand that Rabbi Eliezer would concur with what Unkelus said? Said Rabbi Zalman of Elasha, and look in the Gemara in Megillah, and Daf Gimel, Amad Aleph, and you will see that Unkelus Hager was a Talmud of Rabbi Eliezer. and of Rabbi Yeshua, which means that in his Targum, if you know that, and you know Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Yeshua and all of their halachic disputes, you can perceive sometimes his Targum where it's drawing from. In this instance, he aligned himself with his Rebbe, Rabbi Eliezer, and you can see from the Targum of the Talmud, the position of the Talmud, the position of the Rav. So that's the classic response of Rabbi Zalman of Eloshin. The final response, which is it's the beginning of a discussion, which means we can only talk about it for a moment or two. But it raises another question. We talk about the Jewish people becoming Jewish. When did they become Jewish? Well, if they became Jewish at Har Sinai, we are essentially saying that the Jewish people were not Jewish before Har Sinai. That's quite a statement, and maybe it's true. In so doing, we will be saying that Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah were not Jewish. They were the beginnings of the Jewish people. They were the future of the Jewish people, but no one was Jewish until Mount Har Sinai. Now, that is actually a major question, also debated by Rishonim. It seems that this may be also part of the machlokas between Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer. You see, if you want to know what it takes to become a ger, you'll need to find out when the Jewish people became Jewish. If they became Jewish before Har Sinai, so then look at what happened before Har Sinai, then you'll find the formula for gerus. But if they were Jewish from way back when, you'll have to look at to find out what made them Jewish then. And what illuminates our eyes here is a comment of the Chizkuni. It's one of the Rishonim. He's commenting on Rabbi Eliezer's words. Shekin matzinu ba'avaseinu. They only did Mila. There's no Dila. Who's Avaseinu? Says the Chizkuni. Shekin matzinu ba'avaseinu. Avram, Yitzchak, v'Yaakov. Shemalu v'lo tavlu. We have no knowledge of Tevila. It's not mentioned anywhere in the Pasuk. Which means that really part of the machlokas between Rabbi Eliezer and Yeshua is not only what to make of this Pasuk in Shmos Perek Kaf Dalet. It's whether it's relevant to the discussion at all. Because if they've been Jewish all along, you've got to look back to what made the others Jewish. And as far as we know, Mila we have, right? Tevila there wasn't. That's the base of Rabbi Eliezer's position. And therefore, essentially, Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua are disputing when the Jewish people became Jewish, then you'll find out what it took to make them become Jewish. So these are three classic approaches to understanding Rabbi Eliezer's position. Once again, certainly apropos of our earlier discussion, we should not be surprised that Rabbi Eliezer has said very interesting things, more than interesting, and the halacha is not like him. The halacha is like Rabbi Yeshua. It's got a Mila and Tevila, but this at least is some of the background to the discussion. We'll leave it over there for this week.
We have a million.